Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
More than 7 million Americans have tested positive for the coronavirus, and as we learned early this morning, the President of the United States is among them. President Trump announced his positive test results on Twitter. First Lady Melania Trump has also tested positive, so has a close aide to the president, Hope Hicks, and Republican National Committee Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel. This morning, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi wished the president well on MSNBC.
Every infection is a sad one. The president of the United States, of course, but every single one. Now we've gone over such a high number in our country of infections, every one of them a sad occasion. Over 209,000 deaths, a tragedy beyond even comprehension 1 year ago, and still more to come. But maybe this will be the moment where people will say, okay, mask, distance, sanitation, tracing, treatment.
The United States has more coronavirus infections than any other country in the world, and by far the highest death toll. The U.S. has 4% of the world's population, but has seen 20% of the pandemic deaths. And as the president and his close contacts contend with an outbreak inside the White House, many critics say they could have prevented the infection by taking basic precautions and could have stopped the virus in its tracks if only there had been the political will. Andy Slavitt led the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services under President Obama. We spoke yesterday via Skype before the news about the president's infection broke, and I asked him about an argument that he made back in July in an article for Medium when he said that the United States is always 4 to 6 weeks away from eliminating the virus if we throw the kitchen sink at the problem.
Well, one way to look at what's going on is to look at the numbers you said. You specifically drill in on a place like Africa. Africa is a continent with 1.3 billion people, and they have about 30,000 deaths. What that should tell us is that what we have ahead of us to do is not all that high tech, not all that complex. It really involves a little bit of discipline and a little bit of sacrifice and a little bit of experience and a little bit of empathy would be, I think, the right formula. It's all about very simply not breathing near one another in crowded places. You know, in the scheme of viruses, that's a pretty easy formula, considering that there are viruses that are much more contagious. So we can do this with a series of actions that have been demonstrated around the world. We just have to decide if we want to do it.
Yeah. And let's go through some of those tactics. Your kitchen sink has six parts to it. We can't get to all of them, but we can get to a few here. Starting with universal mask wearing. How do you do that? Is that a national mask mandate?
Well, look, we have to stop fighting each other about masks and start listening to each other about masks and start appealing to each other about masks. You know, we know that there are plenty of people, large majorities of people, that if told that it will save people's lives, will wear masks. We know there are others who have other questions, individual liberties. Maybe they have their own concerns. Maybe they're in low density areas. And we got to listen to those concerns instead of being instantly dismissive, or we're never going to get those people on board. There's no penalty. There's no law that's going to do the job. I do think it starts with a president who will wear a mask himself or herself, demonstrate why it's important, and get all the governors to do the same. Once that happens, I think we'll be much, much, much closer. Right now, we're not even putting in close to the effort that we need.
You're also calling for a near total lockdown, 90%. What would that look like?
So here's what I mean and here's what I don't mean. The last time we went through kind of stay-at-home orders in April, nearly half the population was serving the people that were staying home, picking crops, delivering food, keeping things open. We call these essential workers, but in effect what it meant is the virus circulated much more significantly than we knew. So a number of us were staying home, but many of us were not. So if we want to do this and take this seriously, we really have to actually do what they've done in other countries, which is be much more limited in terms of how many people are circulating. Now, the truth is there's a lot of good news in that there are things that are relatively safe. Individual stores, individual shops, places where people are one-on-one, small family gatherings, those things are relatively safe. We're not concerned about one case of coronavirus. We're concerned about hotspots. There are going to be cases, and we have enough tests for cases. We have enough isolation capability for cases. What we don't have is enough ability to keep schools and universities reliably open if there are outbreaks. So we have to prevent the outbreaks and accept the fact that we can manage the cases aggressively when they come up.
As you know, the most obvious question out of this, I think, is, well, what about the economy? Another 800,000 people filed for unemployment last week and we're barely locked down at all right now. I mean, what would a 90% lockdown do to the economy that's already kind of in tatters?
Here's the question that needs to be begged. Should we consider some short-term pain for long-term gain? I think other countries have been able to see the benefit of some short-term pain, and then they are much more open. Doesn't mean they're off the hook, but they're much more open. We haven't even had that dialogue in the U.S. I think I'm not calling for any action on my own. What I'm suggesting is that the options have never been put on the table for the American public. The American public has sort of been told this is the only way to do it. And we really need to have a national conversation about, is it worth it to have 6 weeks of short-term pain to get the viral level down to near zero? And are we willing to support the businesses and everybody that will go through financial pain during those 6 weeks? That's the smarter way to do it, in my opinion, because the alternative is we have this economy that limps along endlessly. People aren't traveling. People aren't buying cars. People aren't signing leases. People aren't doing really significant amounts of hiring. They're not going to do that unless they feel safer. And how do they feel safer is to take this work done. Now, I talked about this in the summer very specifically because my suggestion was if people wanted schools to open, they had that in their power. Don't go to bars, wear masks, bring the viral count down, and schools will be able to safely open. We have yet to be able to do that, but my point is anytime we want to, it's really about 6 weeks away.
Looking at your list, you also suggest that hotels could be used to isolate people from their families. You say we could prohibit interstate travel, prohibit travel into the country. These are bold measures, clearly, but the United States couldn't even handle the measures that were put in place back in March. It did very little to slow the virus. What makes you think that we have the political and cultural will to do this?
Well, we may not, and that's something we have to face. But look, we're talking here about are we willing to take some measures for 6 weeks that would save hundreds of thousands of lives? You know, we're relatively speaking very unaccustomed to sacrifice anymore in this country. If you told my grandparents, or I'm guessing yours or many other people listening, that they had to sacrifice for 6 weeks that would save hundreds of thousands of lives and get the economy back. These are people who lived through a 10-year depression. They lived through who knows what kind of turmoil in their own countries if they came to the U.S. They lived through a 6-year world war. And, you know, we talk about the freedom that we want to have to not wear masks and the freedom we have to have free speech and assemble in churches. Where do people think those freedoms came from? Those freedoms came from a responsibility to building a culture, building a society that does require a little bit of sacrifice. And we can't lie to people and tell people this will go away if we don't take some measures. And so we have to choose those measures. That measure can be what we've chosen, which is sort of an endless, no end in sight approach, which allows us to limp along. And some parts of society doing quite well, but unfortunately many parts of society, people who are out there working every day and are required to, not doing very well, and many of them at serious risk. Or we can make a decision that as a society, we're going to try to come together and beat this thing, just like we would beat any enemy.
At this point, why not just wait for a vaccine?
I think people have to understand what a vaccine will and won't do. The vaccine doesn't carry the promise of eradicating COVID-19. A vaccine carries a promise of being a great tool in our arsenal that will dramatically reduce the risk of transmission. But the question we don't know is how much immunity will it confer on what percentage of the population or for how long? We should understand that it's more likely to be like a influenza vaccine, which works on 40 to 50% of the population with some levels of effectiveness, but not perfect. And so it will make things easier. It will make things better. But, you know, the U.S. has a habit of waiting for these high-tech scientific solutions to rescue us. And, you know, sometimes that works, but sometimes it requires a little bit on our part. And I'm not suggesting that we do anything other than spend 6 weeks looking out for one another and demonstrating that the people who live among us aren't just strangers we don't care about, but they're people whose lives we're willing to save.
Andy Slavitt led the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services under President Obama. He's also writing a book that will come out next year. It's called Preventable, the inside story of how leadership failures, politics, and selfishness doomed the U.S. coronavirus response. And he's making the case here that the virus could be eradicated in 4 to 6 weeks if there was the political will. Andy, thank you very much.
Anytime.
I spoke with Andy yesterday before news of the president's positive coronavirus test broke. We'll be keeping a close eye on that story throughout the day, how it affects the president's health, what it means for the last month of the presidential campaign, and of course, we'll get reaction from around the country and the world.